I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Welcome back aboard the Starship Texas for the 270th installment of the Text Trek podcast, the home of Star Trek fandom from deep in the heart of Texas, where we take a deep look at Star Trek, old and new. And tonight, we're talking about Star Trek Enterprise, specifically Season 1, Episodes 1 through 9, everything up until Civilization, Season 1, Episode 9. So this will be our first of three discussions of Star Trek Enterprise Season 1. And I'm happy to be doing this with Dave, who this is his first time really, like, giving Enterprise a shot since the last time he gave it a shot.
Right. Well, you have to recall, like, in some ways before I got on the Text Trek bandwagon here, that, there were a few Trek series that I had completed, like TOS, TNG, I suppose, and everything else was spotty. Some of it's still spotty. I think I watched, the first year or so back when.
About a year and a half, but I've pieced
together.
Year
and a half is what I think. I know I got into season two and at some point derailed a little bit, and then I saw a shiny object and moved elsewhere.
Yeah, you got into season two, but you didn't see Florida.
Maybe I was watching
spoilers.
Let's
try not to do like too many Enterprise spoilers so that people can listen to this, because it's kind of a timeless topic, like people will always be rewatching any Star Trek show. So
yeah, and this, like DS9, although I kind of know about its infamous ending, but only portions of that, and most of the path there, the long road, I don't know much about.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah, no, season four is one of my favorite seasons of Star Trek. It does have like a bad episode as the final episode, but there's a bunch of good ones before you get to that one.
Yeah, no, I'm excited.
Well, good. I'm excited too. We had a lot of fun doing this with DS9, and we've covered the animated series, and we haven't done like a ton other like legacy shows. Every now and then we'll talk about Voyager or the original series or whatever, whenever it's relevant or for whatever reason we're shining a light on it. We have talked about a couple Enterprise episodes previously. We talked about the premiere Broken Bow that we'll mention a little bit. Tonight we talked about the Mirror Universe episode. Speaking of season four, and I think that better quality? I don't know, more to my likings, we'll say. Like, yeah, more made for me.
We even talked about a spooky episode when we did our Halloween spotlight once upon a time.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've hit a few episodes, but they've just been sort of strays.
Yeah, so it'll be some fun stuff to look forward to, getting to eventually. It's funny how often you can say, like, it might be a long road, getting there or whatever. how often you can, factor that song into anything, but I guess, like, I don't know, when you're just like a song about like platitudes and kind of nothing, you kind of faith of the heart, like that doesn't mean anything. Faith of the heart, we can just like, come on, you gotta have faith of the heart, like that, what the hell does that even mean?
Hey, but listen, I could argue, Fathery, that it's distinct from religious faith, that it's faith of the heart is more about self-reliance. You can argue that that's sort of like a little bit of American type values, or you could put it as a little propagandistic, but I can argue that it's got some meaning. I know it's like a cheesy power ballad too, but
yeah, that'll be a curious thing for people to weigh in on, I guess. This, speaking of timeless things, like this debate, it used to not be a debate. It used to just be like everyone hated it, and then now all of a sudden it's like I think it's just shifted to where like within the fandom, I think a majority like it. I think it's gone that far.
Wow, okay.
And when we started Text Trek, that wasn't the case at all. I was like, everyone agrees with me, it's a bad song, so.
Jill just asked the question that will vex me forever. Even though, Father, you have told me the right answer to this question, it has a definitive answer.
I think
answer.
I've said the name of the episode a couple times already tonight.
It is Broken Bow?
Yes.
That is the name of the place, right?
Or the town in Oklahoma.
Town in Oklahoma, yeah. But, like, because ships have bows and stuff, like, my brain is always trying to make everything nautical in Star Trek. So, yeah, I'm, believe me, I will misspeak.
Yeah. I remember in, like, 2001, someone on the internet being like, is it broken bow or broken bow? And then someone being, like, in the comments, like, Brandon Braga said it's broken bow. And I was like, oh, I've never questioned it. But I see that you're not alone, that other people have had that same issue.
Jill, who is, I know, like one of the bigger Enterprise fans among our listener and viewership, asked the question. So if Jill asked the question, it's a legit question. And I know she's doing a rewatch. I think I saw, okay, because Eternal was also doing the rewatch. So hopefully some other people have joined us or will join us. The strike left, you know, is going to make some holes in the year. And so it's given us this opportunity, which is kind of exciting. I, you know, even beyond whatever I get out of the show itself, you know, there is something to be said. I just feel like I'm learning more Trek lore. I will know more when all this is done about the universe and key events and the formative days of the Enterprise and, you know, stuff like that. So that's pretty exciting, too.
Yeah, well, before we get into our main topic, just a little bit of quick housekeeping. We, of course, have to give a big thank you and shout out to the wonderful Text Trek Patreon supporters. If not for them, we would not be able to do a weekly live show. So thank you. Thank you so much. Starfleet, Sohel, Cake is Eternal, Crazy Dutchie, Joanne Robertson, John Daw, Geek Filter, Earl Grey Trekkie, Quarks Bar, Benjinium, Stephanie Durantes, Matthew Averett, Braxton, Chuck A, and our anonymous supporters. We're going to be having a watch party on January 20th. Check the Text Trek Discord for the exact time. We might try to do that one a little later so Robbie can make it. But yeah, we're going to toss on a DS9 episode and a Strange New Worlds episode. Dave, I think we can just, you know, go into this randomly and just be like, hey, give us a random DS9 episode and a random Strange New Worlds episode. I trust those shows enough. I'm willing to roll the dice on it. If the crowd that shows up, if the patrons that show up, we can veto it if it's just a very unpopular one. But otherwise, I say we just trust in these shows and see what, let's have some, instead of faith of the heart, let's have faith of the quality of two of the best Star Trek shows ever.
Alan Moraine, count to 10.
I love it's count to 4, by the way, but
oh man, I knew you would know.
I've sang a heavy metal cover to that song before.
Yeah, no, you are one of its core defenders. I liked the episode. I'm not going to diss. I'm just worried, Fathery, that when we've got everybody in the room on Discord, and that they're going to start fighting, and somebody's going to be like, "That episode sucks. Why are we doing this?"
Well, we'll do that unless Dave has till the 20th to talk me out of it, which he might
All
do.
Right,
he can be very convincing.
We'll see, but honestly, I have faith of the viewership. So I we don't fight among Text Trek and our crew. We're more like the TNG crew in that sense.
The TNG crew, they get along pretty well, like on camera and off camera. So
yeah, that's right.
Unlike some other shows. But yes, that'll be going on January 20th. If you're watching this live on YouTube Friday on January 12th tomorrow, please check out John Billingsley and the Trek Talks. They're doing their streaming telethon that they do annually for the Hollywood Food Coalition. We talked a bit about that last week.
Star-studded.
Yeah, so a lot of cool panels. It's basically just like an online Star Trek convention.
For a great cause.
And just a little bit of news, like local news we don't get to talk about very often. But the we found out the premiere of Star Trek Discovery Season 5, the final season, will be here in Austin, Texas during South by Southwest. So that's going to be the second week of March, sometime between the 8th and the 16th. Very soon, you know, 2 months away, it'll be premiering here. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. Very cool. More Trek on the big screen. I'm always for it.
And, and speaking of the big screen, there's a bit of movie news. There's yet another Paramount Pictures has like another Star Trek movie in development. This one is interesting. It has like some big names attached with Toby Haynes, the Andor director, and Seth Graham Smith, who's done like a ton of writing. He wrote like those, Vampire and Prejudice and Abraham Lincoln. Pride and Prejudice and Zombies and Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter and like all of that stuff. But I think he's like a really good writer because he's like a script doctor is how he, you know, like people like Joss Whedon and Quentin Tarantino, like, you know, kind of like
they came in.
Yeah. So like they're like people that are like actually like, you know, good writers or I guess quick writers, you know, you gotta have like some type of talent to do that. So, but, you know, we've seen like big names like Noah Hawley, the Fargo guy, and hell, Quentin Tarantino himself, I was just mentioning, so no guarantee that this will happen, but it's kind of exciting. We'll see. Paramount definitely wants to do movies at some point. Beyond was almost a decade ago, so when they have it figured out, they'll pump out something. They have a pretty big property, and there's not been a Star Trek movie in a while, so... I would not be surprised if there is something in development within like the next couple of years, but I think I would have said that at like any point since Beyond came out. So Take that as you will.
Yeah, I saw Rachel made a TikTok, and she's just like, "I'll believe it when I'm sitting in the theater watching it."
The funny thing is, I think Rachel makes like that TikTok like every time. Also, like might be like the fourth time she's made that.
It's timeless. She could probably just rerun it.
Yeah, each one kind of, you know, it becomes like more and more valid every time she does it. So, but enough about all of this stuff going on in 2024. Let's go back in time to a simpler era of 2001. Or 2001.
Very relaxed period for our country.
I remember at the time, I was always confused. Like after the year 2000, are we going to say like 2001? Are we going to say like 2001? Will it be 2001 with no and? I thought it was going to be like such like a big deal. Like we have to have like a huge like debate about it. And then, but like, it just turns out like, you can just say whatever. People know what you mean.
Yeah, it's true. Americans are not big on a consensus. You know, we're a melting pot. I guess that kind of makes some sense. But also, efficiency is not our big thing. It's why we reject the metric system.
Too efficient. But they use the metric system in Star Trek most of the time, and whenever they don't, it super annoys me. I can't imagine how, like, people...
I don't like it. I'm an American. I want to know how many miles away they are, not calicams.
Or kilometers is what they normally use. I like how you made it something even more, like, exotic and
listen,
and foreign.
It might as well be when they say kilometers. I'm like, wait, is that a little bigger than a mile or a little less? I can't remember.
Well, Dave, let's start our talk of Star Trek Enterprise Season 1 with the beginning, the series premiere, Broken Bow. Just before we go into this, I want to let folks know we've discussed this episode in much more detail 7 years ago.
Oh my god.
In Text Trek number 21, I believe. So, just in context, this is number 270. So it was what, 159 podcast episodes ago, not counting the supplementals that don't get numbered.
That was with our friend Chris Jones, I believe.
Yeah, with Chris Jones. Good dude. Oh, hell, that might have been like the last time I talked to him. I ought to go like check in on him, see how he's doing.
He's doing all right. But yeah, so we did the big coverage of it then, so we're going to do a kind of, just a real brisk, I guess encapsulation and, what was our, how what kind of footing did this show get off on the ground with for us?
Written by Rick Berman and Brannon Braga, directed by James L. Conway, and the synopsis is, Earth launches its first starship of exploration, Enterprise, on a mission to return an injured Klingon to his homeworld. If you want to hear like the detailed stuff from me, check out Text Trek number 21, I think. But if you want like the too long didn't read version, this is one of my favorite Star Trek premieres. Yeah, Star Trek Enterprise, ironically, it's my least favorite Star Trek show, and I still like a lot of stuff in it. But this is one of my favorite premieres. The only one I like more than it is DS9 out of all the legacy stuff, or maybe like out of anything. I just love DS9 because I love those characters so much. But yeah, I think the production value is great. I loved seeing like a new show, just getting like follow the development of it. I thought that the look of the Enterprise of the NX-01, like I really bought into all of that stuff. Seeing first contact with the Klingons was cool. There was like some silly stuff in there too that I kind of rolled my eyes at, and that stuff would continue to be kind of a bigger deal in these early seasons of Enterprise. But temporal Cold War was neat. I don't really get why T'Pol stays at the end, other than like, oh, you're going to be a regular on the show. It kind of doesn't really make sense that she would want to stick around on the Enterprise. I wish, or just Enterprise. I don't say the, which annoys me, but yeah, other than that, like, I don't really have much I would complain about it. The it was just, it presents itself well. I think like the action, the pacing, all that stuff, you get like a good sense of who Archer is and his relationships with like T'Pol and Trip. So you kind of get like a good idea of the show, I think, going into this premiere, this two-part premiere. But what about you?
Father, I guess you could argue that, you remember like when Archer's unconscious, he wakes up and he thinks that T'Pol must have taken command and turned him around and gone home. And then, Trip is like, no, sir, she anticipated what you wanted to do and we're headed to the Suliban and all that. And I'm like, I think you can at least intuit
she must have seen something of Merritt and Archer that was beyond just, and his crew, beyond just, well, you know, I'm on this crew, I'm supposed to, you know, obey the captain and do what he thinks. She must have seen some Merritt, and
maybe
why she stayed.
Articulate that. Maybe, like, have that in...
It's too bad she doesn't have a confidant. I feel like Dr. Phlox could have been that person, sort of.
Or she just says it later when she's like comfortable, like, right. like why did you stick around with us, T'Pol? Like, oh, because like I saw merit in you. But Dave, before we move on to fight or flight, do you have anything in addition to say?
Yeah, I'm just gonna. I agree with you that it's like it delivers a lot of goods. It like has some clear cut character arcs. I think it has a great cold open with that Klingon action sequence, and it's great to see the Klingons with the classic designs, of course.
Well, that wasn't the classic design. That was the modern. That was a controversial thing. That pissed people off. They were like, why don't they look like TOS flathead Klingons? This is a prequel.
Right. I was saying it in as a counterpoint, I suppose, to Discovery. It was essentially staying with what people knew at the time, which was they'd had several decades of Klingons that looked like that, or not several, a couple decades at least. I can see why. I think at the time I probably would have wanted them to look like classic TOS Klingons, but I always have to give it up for the design work of the, you know, the modern era Klingons, and I think they look great. And I think that's also that kind of Klingons give an energetic shot in the arm to a premiere. But I like the cast. I liked the big reveal that the Vulcans were as sort of manipulative and paternalistic and critical as they were. You know, that was I think another interesting controversial thing.
Yeah,
and we'll talk about that more because it's in every it shows up in almost every single episode in one way, shape, or form. Let's see, the only thing, and I'll say this is kind of what my prejudices are going into this show, is that I feel like most of the core cast is strong, but I feel like I'm anticipating Mayweather and Reed not having a lot to do and being sort of weak characters, and that sort of is how they felt in that first episode, although I actually thought Mayweather in particular could have been like this guy who always knows some little cool secret about, you know, having been in space so long. And, you know, that would have been super awesome if he was just always had some kind of, you know, hack essentially for a situation.
That's like exactly what you said in Text Trek 21. Did you go back and re-listen to that? Or
no, but I know I always felt that way.
And just what you said about Reed and Mayweather. Yeah.
But yeah, that's, I'll be interested to see if there's some episodes that surprise me. You know, like, I know some people feel like Chakotay was always a boring character, but when I watch Voyager, I can find episodes where I think he's pretty good, and I like him broadly, and so maybe I'll get to that place with them.
Yeah, Chakotay's finally started to grow on me, but I get those characters too. I got a few.
We'll also talk about the kind of slightly schlocky, let's bring some sex to Trek scenes, which, you know, I kind of have mentioned wanting that at times, but I guess what I want is something less lurid and a little more mature. But Trek does also at least have in its tradition, you know, a little cheesecake and some beefcake in this.
And sexiness. Like, that was important to Gene. He wanted a lot of sexiness in the shows, so.
Yeah.
The Rick Berman approach with Enterprise was a bit. Yeah, like, and I think a lot of it was, like, influenced by, like, the UPN network. They were like, no, we're gonna have, like, sexier, like, hot, pretty people than the WB, so let's do this thing. We're throwing down the gauntlet.
Right.
I think they were like, WB wants to be, like, safe for teens. It's like, okay, we're gonna be, like, as we're gonna get as pornographic as the FEC will allow a network to do. So.
The only other thought that I wanted to mention was, like, I think that the episode also planted the seeds of what I assume are kind of, like, the major thematics of the show, or at least it is in all the episodes I've watched so far, which is that, that humans are kind of dangerously, they are actually too inexperienced, but also that, it is their time to kind of take to the stars, but they're going to be, they actually do need some checks and balances and, you know, to do some growing up, even though they're a little bit full of themselves because they're like, hey, we eliminated poverty, yo. We stopped war. we know what's up.
And disease.
And disease. Like,
there's really three big accomplishments.
I would get cocky about that too. But then, you know, the next thing, you know, they're breaking the Prime Directive because they don't even have it yet. And, you know, Trip was about to, like, yell at that kid like he was watching a mom spank her kid in HEB.
There's something I'm going to say about, HEB, our fantastic Texas grocery stores that are probably the reason why I will never move anywhere. Well, eventually HEB will get terrible because some bigger corporation will buy it and make it terrible. But until that happens, I'll always live where there's an HEB. But in addition to that, Dave, I got some comments on that scene, actually, that I'm going to save until a future episode. And I'm like, man, they really missed an opportunity here because of this thing that happened in Broken Bow. Not Broken Bow, but Broken Bow. But yeah, I think that's something that'll come up next week, actually. So
okay, all right, cool. But we'll have a little bit of a callback.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's sort of my main stuff. Oh, and I thought the Temporal Cold War, what an evocative name. I have no idea if they live up to it at all or if it kind of all just falls apart. But I think that's such a cool name, and it's, you know, it's almost like it promises maybe more than they can deliver. Is that dude at the who's hidden? Is that Soval? It sure sounded like him, and I feel like it was, but I don't guess. The
future guy is never revealed.
What? Was he voiced by that? He sounds so much like him.
No.
It, you know, with a little distortion added, but okay. I was like, oh, this is going to be some big... That sounds like the kind of reveal that they might have. The Vulcans are secretly involved and have kept it a secret, but okay.
But they do wrap up the Temporal Cold War.
What season?
4. That's how
oh my god.
That's how season 4 opens.
Oh, wow. Okay. I guess I thought we were going to say, like, at the end of season 1 or by season 2 or something. Okay. It's a big thing.
Yeah. Well, I guess Cold Wars tend to they last long, so...
It's by their very nature. I think that first episode is a good mix of nostalgia and new stuff. Like, I even noticed that they mentioned Tholia in it. That was cool.
That is cool, yeah. That's one of my favorite little uses of the universe. It got me excited. It was like, oh, we're going to get Tholians on this show, and then they never went new. Kind of like in modern Star Trek, they did a short trek mentioning the Tholians, and I'm like, oh, cool, in Strange New Worlds, we're gonna have Tholians, and then I get Strange New Worlds, and the Tholians are nowhere to be seen, although apparently they tried to get them in season 1, but that didn't happen, but maybe season 3, when we see that next year in 2025, probably.
Wait, didn't Discovery show a Tholian web being created?
No.
I've seen that done with modern effects, but maybe, am I just thinking of Enterprise, the episode?
Yes.
Where, that's right, because that had the ship, the Defiant, right?
Yeah, but not that Defiant. Ooh.
Yeah, the TOS Defiant.
Yes.
The Constitution class Defiant. In a plot that I thought was great.
But Broken Bow ends with Travis being like, well, where to, Captain? And there's an ion storm dead ahead. And Archer just being like, you can't be afraid of the wind, Ensign, like my dad taught me. Let's go on ahead. I thought like they would like warp into it and just like get exploded by the ion storm. But no, they make it off to... I guess the inhabited world they were going to, but like the only inhabitant there is a space worm, because that's how the next episode opens. But
right.
That brings us to episode 3. We'll count it as 3. Broken Bow counts as 2.
Yep.
So we get episode 3, Fight or Flight, also written by Rick Berman and Brannon Braga, which is kind of a warning sign going into Star Trek Enterprise. Like, man, like these two dudes sure are doing like a lot of the writing themselves. And, like, Rick Berman's not really a writer. So he's like, for a guy who's like not really like a writer, he's getting like super involved. But directed by Alan Craker.
Okay.
Synopsis reads, Enterprise finds an abandoned ship filled with corpses, which appear to have been used for an experiment. Dave, I gave a good bit of praise to Broken Bow. This one is very much like a bit of a slog, and I remember being like, I don't know, kind of disappointed, and just in 2001, it felt like kind of weak sauce coming after the, you know, the big premiere. But I don't know, how do you feel about Fight or Flight?
I kind of agree, although I love kind of just on... I'm a pretty easy get on derelict ship stories, you know, with dead alien crews and stuff inside. I think it's cool and spooky and all that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a letdown. Honestly, this is the one that starts with them kind of bored, right? They're like, oh, we're just looking at star clusters and boring shit. And I just like, that's not a good way to start to have the crew bored.
It's a frustration of mine in season 1 of Enterprise is just like how much they kind of suck at everything and how lame they are. And I think there's like a good way to do that and a bad way to do that. And they do a bit of both, I suppose, in the show. But here...
It's like a realistic idea. I kind of like, on some level, appreciate, I'm like, yeah, that they, you know, they might just find it's drier than they expected at first. But yeah, it's... Is it dramatic? Is it fun to watch? Not necessarily.
Yeah, it's just like, hey, look, like, our ship doesn't work, and we don't know how to do anything, and we have, like, torpedoes, but we don't even know how to hit an asteroid, and we almost might shoot ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if
they can't even shoot well.
If you're going to show them kind of, I don't know, struggling with, like, the dangers of space and stuff, then, like, make space seem, like, cool and dangerous and deadly, and more on this a little bit when we get to our next episode, Strange New World, but it is kind of funny, though. I do kind of laugh at the idea, and I kind of like the realism of it, of, oh, well, we thought we were going to go, you know, make first contact, you know, seek out strange new life on new worlds, meet new civilizations, all of that stuff. You know, we watched the original series, we know, like, the William Shatner speech, and then they get out here, and T'Pol's like, yeah, only one out of every 43,000 planets supports intelligent life, assholes. Like, you're probably gonna have to cruise around for a while in your little slow-ass, you know, ship. You're only going warp 3. You know, watch any other Star Trek show, warp 3 sounds slow as hell. And yeah, like, you know, you're not gonna just find, you know, like a new civilization around every corner. I did appreciate that being mentioned.
There is a certain realism that I kind of, like, at least on some level appreciate, although the me that wants drama has more say in this and wished it had been a little bit more exciting. I have a quick question. You know, T'Pol says, at some point, like, my people don't share your enthusiasm for exploration. And I know Vulcans have different depictions and they lean different ways at times, but, like, I feel like sometimes they show them having real zeal for it, even though, you know, there's a little barely contained emotion in them for it. It seemed a little weird for them to just say, oh yeah, we don't really care.
That's very much like the way that the Vulcans are in Enterprise.
I guess so.
And it did ruffle a lot of feathers, and we'll see more, like, the Vulcans, like, being assholes, and I think a lot of people, like, weren't prepared for that going in. A lot of people were kind of offended by it, and, you know, there wasn't a ton of Vulcan representation in Berman-era Star Trek until Tuvok and Voyager, and he was mostly just a one Vulcan by himself. Every now and then we'd see, like, another Vulcan in Voyager or on DS9. TNG really didn't like Vulcans.
And then when they finally show here, they're assholes.
Yeah, so, you know, but I kind of like the idea that Rick Berman and Brandon Braga had was that they wanted to show the Vulcans had growing to do also, that Archer and humanity, they're not at, like, Picard's level yet. They're still working their way up there, and the Vulcans, you know, the Vulcans ain't Spock. They're still working on it.
I actually think thematically that is a very strong idea, that these guys who in some ways are very aspirational for, you know, Starfleet, have their own problems. You know, very often we are so human-centric in these stories, and that's the story we like to tell about humans in a lot of Star Treks, which is, you know, problems, but there's potential. And it's like, oh, well, you know, that even applies to the guys that they admire.
I'm just going to shout out, like, some quick thoughts on this episode, but
sure.
Yeah, like, Archer does seem like, I don't know, he kind of gets on my nerves a little bit, but Scott Bakula has, like, he has some good line deliveries, like his speech, when he gives a speech about, like, you know, going back, and if you don't remember, like, you know, they find the ship full of dead aliens, and they freak out and run away, and then he's like, oh, I gotta go back and try to, you know, I don't know what he's gonna do to, like, help them, but I guess, like, investigate whoever, you know, T'Pol even says, like, what are you doing? You know, like, these people are already dead. You know, we might piss people off if we're, like, messing with their bodies and stuff. And he's like, oh, well, you know, we like, owe it to their loved ones, you know, whatever. Like,
right.
But I like that speech he gives when he's like, you know, it took humans a few thousand years to get a sense of what to do, but I think we are finally starting to get things right. And I can't believe I almost ignored it. It's like, well, I do kind of like his cheesy speech, just the Scott Bakula's delivery. But what also annoys me in this episode is that it's like, okay, if you're going to make, like, your whole story about how, like, it's like, oh, Archer really wants to have, like, a first contact. It's like, this is going to be, like, his first contact. And it's going to be, like, this big, it's like, humanity, like, went out into space to explore, and here's the first time they, like, they show up in, like a strange new world and meet people. And he finds, like, this ship, and he meets this, you know, he's all happy to meet these people. And then, you know, it's a nightmare, you know, they find, like, all these dead people hanging upside down. And then when they finally get, like, the first contact at the end, and Archer's like, oh, the Axanar are really cool. Turns out they're androgynous and live over 400 years. And it's like, oh, we have an explanation of, like, the Axanar, like, the thing we heard about, like, a battle at Axanar in the original series that now is, like, a big, like, a, you know, a fan film, infamous, thing.
Right.
It's like,
oh, hot potato.
So, okay, if you're going to use something, like, from the universe, then, like, do something with it. But I feel like it kind of, like, squanders, you know, Axanar, whatever that is. Oh, apparently they're androgynous people who live for 400 years, but we never actually see the first contact. We don't get to see, like, Archer, you know, like, interacting with them, or, like, the, like, humans' first contact happens off screen.
Yeah. that might have been a bit of an oops. But I know that they will go on to give Enterprise a lot of firsts, so...
I guess this decision to return does show that Enterprise takes... Archer kind of takes more like an interventionalist kind of approach.
Yeah, I kind of didn't like how he framed it in such a sort of binary way early on, where he's like, well, we could do nothing and go away, and he even said, kind of, I think he's a little accusative towards T'Pol, like, oh, do you just want us to walk away? Or you go in and, like, this very risky, uninformed kind of way. You know, it's like, oh, well, maybe there might be actually some, you know, decent compromises in there with, let's take some scans, let's figure some shit out. Now, I know that's not a show, right? You gotta make the show interesting. But sometimes I think, although I, like you, I like a little Archer speechifying, but I also don't like him necessarily kind of saying, acting like T'Pol, this is something that they'll do throughout. She's kind of the buzzkill, right? She's what Worf was to TNG, where Worf always had the idea that was kind of wrong for the situation. Although T'Pol has a better track record than Worf on that. She's actually correct in a fair number of these situations, but we're meant to think, she's keeping holding the fun back. She's keeping them from exploring and being human.
Yeah, so I guess they kind of, like, reiterate that tension. They don't really, like, add anything to it, but they just kind of, like, repeat it just to, you know, make it, like, sink into the audience's head.
It does make sense to kind of, that's a thematic thing for the whole show, so you do kind of probably want to repeat it in the first episode, in case people didn't see the opening two-parter or something. The first episode proper, I guess.
I don't know, the show still has, like, the horniness that they wanted, that, like, Rick Berman really wanted the show to have, and I think came from the UPN network people, but, you know, when Phlox is like, these two ensigns are preparing to mate, do you think they'll let me watch, and,
yeah,
you know, stuff like that. Admiral Forrest says, you know, making history with every light year, I think that was something, like, they actually, like, said some of the trailers. And I like seeing the armory when we see them, like, working on the torpedo. It's like, oh, we get, like, this cool armory set. Yeah. That is like, a cool thing I like in this episode. Because it's kind of like in the original series when they have, like, the torpedo room and the phaser bank room. And it's like, oh, there's, like, a different part of the ship where they're shooting the stuff from. So that was cool. But that's all I got on Fight or Flight. You have anything else before we move on to Strange New Worlds? Or is this Strange New World, singular?
Yeah. They put some work into that, into the armory stuff, and they'll use it again in the future, of course. It's cool looking. You see the automated thing loading him up. You know, it's got that sort of vibe of, you know, watching old World War II movies and stuff. Or, it's just mainly World War II sub-movies, but, you know, we'll still see it sometimes in, like, Red October and stuff. Malcolm is actually also a little bit of the Worf that kind of, he's got the, when all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail vibe.
Very militant. He's the Hawk.
Right now, it's kind of his main personality thing, but he's not like, you know, he can joke around. He's a little bit more of a laid-back Hawk, I guess. You know, Hoshi gets a focus in this episode, and I wanted to say, I actually really liked something that Tripp said early on. He said, I wish I had an ear for languages. The captain's going to need a translator with him a lot more than more often than an engineer. And I thought that was cool to see the role spotlighted. And at the same time, Hoshi has a pretty obvious arc in this one.
Yeah.
She's a little too scared.
That is something we need to point out. They do give, like, a big Hoshi spotlight, and she does get, like, the climax of the episode. Like, it is, like, on her to do, like, do your thing, do your communication thing.
And I think the actress does a good job of it.
Linda Park,
yeah. She actually felt like she was, like, so anxious at the end. Like, I felt like she was, like, almost the actress was on the verge of tears, or the character was. And because, you know, this is a super dangerous situation, and these aliens, bad guy aliens who show up for the bodies, are basically collecting, like, the rhino horns of the space waves.
Yeah, they're making space Viagra, and they're going to do that with human lymph nodes also. So that's
so gross, you know, Father.
That's very Brannon Braga. That's like Brannon Braga loved the weird sci-fi. The guy who wrote Threshold, like, he loves, like, the weird sci-fi stuff, and we get a lot of that in early Enterprise. You know,
I think this is a much better weird idea than Threshold, though. Like, that's there would be something like that, and God, sex drive is such a big thing that there's going to be some sort of creepy abuses like that. And this way, what is at least better than, like, maybe a human trafficking story, which might be a little too unpleasant at times. So, you know, I actually think
it'd be more like a organ harvesting, I guess.
You think this is?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, but it's organ harvesting specifically for, like, rich old people who want boners, I presume.
Yeah, oh, yeah, because you still have, like, that sex trade element to it also, so it's super weird, yeah.
But on one level, I think, cool idea. On the other, I think that I sort of wish, you know, that could have actually been discussed a little bit more. It could have been a little bit more of the issue. But anyway, I think Hoshi's arc was obvious and a little clumsy, but Linda Park still made it work well. So I like the episode okay, but it was also a letdown after the two-parter.
Let's move on to episode 4, Strange New World. Not to be confused with Strange New Worlds, plural, the show. A teleplay by Mike Sussman and Phyllis Strong. Story by Rick Berman and Brandon Braga. So they're at it again. Directed by David Livingston. An Enterprise landing party believes T'Pol is conspiring with a species of rock creatures on a strange Class M planet. So this is our first away team, first landing party episode. It would have made, to me, sense to do this before you do, like, your first contact episode. Like, we know they went down somewhere to pick up that worm, and then we saw them at the end of the last episode drop off the worm, so they've gone to planets before. So, I don't know. For me, I was like, oh, you gotta do your first landing party adventure episode, you know, before you have, like, the worm. They could have found the worm on this episode and then do the other one, but I have some of the same complaints about this one. I think it's just very dull. It's just not much happens, and this is the first time I get, like, a sense of kind of early Enterprise has a very derivative nature to it, and it just, this felt like so much of, like, Star Trek been there, done that, as far as, like, oh, we're, like, in caves, and there's spores, and it's all shot, like, out in a park in Los Angeles, and it looks very, like, Southern California. It's like, I don't know, it's just, nothing in it is, like, bad, or, like, irritates me, or, like, gets on my nerves, but it's just a bit dull and boring, and didn't add much to anything, but what do you think about it?
There are a lot of Star Trek premises, Fathery, that have people where their behavior, you know, like Naked Time and stuff like that, where they become extreme versions of themselves or paranoid versions of themselves, etc. And there was something about it to me that was just kind of unpleasant to watch these characters I'm starting to like, you know, yell at each other. Like, is it Connor Trinneer? Is that who plays Trip?
Yes, he plays Trip Tucker.
Like, I think he did a very good job of indicating the breakdown that he has, the paranoia. But once you kind of get the idea about halfway through the show, you're like, okay, I get it. And yet you're going to get, like, you know, 20 more minutes of it, or, and it's a lot. I actually did like the spooky stuff, like the kind of, except that we, you know, is once we know it's all just visions, it's undercut. But, you know, I thought the storm and stuff actually looked cool. And, you know, the eerie alien merging, you know, coming out of the rocks and stuff. That actually, those were at least well-filmed spookiness. There was a bug in Trip's sleeping bag that I thought looked like the conspiracy bug.
Yeah.
From TNG.
Yeah, that's fun. But I'm going to disagree with you on the storm and the rock creature. I'm very underwhelmed by those, and it, like, after, like, watching a bit of the Lost in Space show on Netflix and seeing, like, how, like, dangerous and perilous, like, they make space and other planets look compared to that, like, when I watch this, it's like, man, like, this Enterprise crew, this NX-01 crew, they can't even survive, like, a sunny day in the park, you know, like, they try, like, the shuttle comes to pick them up because it's too windy, it's like, the wind is, it's like, you can't even, like, land your shuttle to pick up your crew because, like, the wind is too bad, and, like, it doesn't even, like, look that bad, like, I live through worse weather all the time living in Central Texas. It's just like,
wait, Father, the wind just like yesterday.
Yeah, it's just, it's just, like, I don't know, it just makes these people seem kind of lame and, like, not cool, especially compared to, like, other Trek shows. I think there was, like, a better way to show, like, this is us just, like, starting off at this, and, you know, sometimes Enterprise does look good, and sometimes they do it bad, and this was a bit of them doing it bad, or at least in a boring way, in my opinion.
I think that I'm used to reading intent sometimes in, you know, with special effects and stuff, and I felt like it came through pretty well. I still like that.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a criticism of the writing there. It was, like, of the production value. But that stuff's still open to criticize.
By the way, there's a bit where Trip calls Mayweather a boomer. He's like, boomers, yeah, or whatever. Has that been memed? It has to have been memed, right?
Not that I've seen, but I don't know. It's hard because, yeah, but it sounds awkward now. Like, no one said, like, boomer like that, but you would always say, like, baby boomer if you were talking about, like, a baby boomer.
Right, but he was a space boomer. Yeah. You know, that was their own thing.
The generation of humans born in space with, like, all the colonies that needed supplies transported back and forth and whatnot. So it's, but that is, like, you know, cool world building. I agree with you that, like, they don't give the character Travis Mayweather, like, a lot of, like, good stuff to do, but I think Anthony Montgomery actually, like, really excels in particular moments when they when he can find something of substance. I love him telling the ghost story. I think actually Anthony Montgomery is a great actor on Star Trek Enterprise whenever he's not doing like, well, gee, Captain, me as a space boomer, you know, I'm excited about a warp 5. Like anytime that he's not doing like the one thing that like the writers gave him, like, okay, we have like this one novel idea and we're going to build his entire personality around that. And right. It's like, okay, whenever like they weren't writing that one thing for him, Anthony Montgomery is really good. And it makes me sad that he didn't get like more of that type of material, because he's incredibly underserved. They do flesh him out a bit in season 4 when, you know, I'm going to say this a lot when we talk about Star Trek Enterprise, but like there's so much I love in season 4, and including like some of these characters I find much more bland early on, like Hoshi and Travis and Reed. They get more depth and become more interesting in season 4. Not like a, you know, like radically, but I'll say they move from like one-dimensional characters to two-dimensional characters.
Okay. They get some more memorable scenes.
Yeah, no, I'll say stuff. Three. They become three-dimensional.
Huh?
That's so arbitrary. Like, no, like who's going to like decide if I'm right or wrong on that? I'll say like they're nine-dimensional. They're 47-dimensional. What the hell?
Somebody come back and call us out on it. I thought at the end they almost had like a kind of a cool moment going where Archer's trying to talk Trip down, and they're also trying to indicate stuff like T'Pol should be doing to help them out, and it's awkward because, you know, Trip could go off at any moment. Oh, and then by the way, there was a cool gross scene where they beam up a dude and he's got like rocks and grass and stuff sticking out of him.
That's cool. And that was supposed to be like the first person to die in the show. Yeah. But you know, like in Star Trek, like, yeah, like people die, you know, like space is dangerous, you know, it's like, it wouldn't be that big of a deal for that to be like a fatality and, you know, by like Star Trek rules for most shows. But I think it was Scott Bakula who was the one who was like, wait a minute, this should be like a big deal if someone died, you know, like they weren't expecting this level of danger. That's kind of like a big thing. We in the previous episodes.
I did read about that. And I actually think he's right. I think,
yeah,
you don't want to too early on start making casualties kind of commonplace.
Yeah, so it is kind of a big deal. I won't spoil when it happens for those who have not seen it, but it is a while before Archer loses anyone under his command, so...
You know why? It's because he takes all the physical abuse himself.
Yeah, well, we saw him get beat up a little bit in Broken Bow, and we're gonna have some more of that in a couple
Andorians,
of episodes.
Oh my god, it's like next level beatdowns.
And there's reasons for that.
But I don't think I have much more to say about it. It was, again, kind of a sluggish start.
Yeah, and I just it makes the characters seem kind of just lame and dumb, you know, so early into the show's foundation. And but I'll say this, I do like, I guess, like the moral of the message or whatever, like the meaning of the story with the challenge your preconceptions or they will challenge you. That's about as Star Trek as it gets.
Yeah, that is true.
It's a very anticlimactic reveal that it's like, oh, we were just like high on spores and tripping balls right the whole time, and there is nothing dangerous here. I guess like the fact they were going to be poisoned if they didn't get like the cure beamed down to them, you know, they were going to die. But like beyond that, there wasn't, you know, like anything of danger. But yeah, that was Strange New World. Seemed more like, I don't know, boring, familiar park down the street, but Strange New World. Let's move on to Episode 5, Unexpected, also written by Rick Berman and Brandon Braga. So, you know, when I'm watching this in 2001 and I see that in the opening credits, I'm like, I'm getting worried. I don't know. But directed by Mike Vahar, when Trip Tucker assists an alien vessel with repairs, a friendly encounter with one of the crew leads to rather unexpected consequences. And yes, Trip Tucker actually becomes pregnant with a lizard lady's baby. I'm talking about Brandon Braga wanted to do like weird stuff. Like, I feel like this was him being like, I'm going to out weird Threshold. I'm going to get even weirder. I'm going to take like, oh, this character, Trip Tucker, and we're going to make him get pregnant.
I can't organize my thoughts around this, and I even have notes on it. It's like not quite, they kind of want to treat it tongue in cheek at times. And that it's not particularly funny, you know, and yet there's something, they could have kind of gotten into serious issues like, oh, does he bear any responsibility for this? What is going to happen after the kid is born and stuff like that, if he's not a part of the kid's life? Like, those could have been some interesting discussions, and instead it's mostly gags about, like, I have a nipple on my wrist.
Which that's kind of a weird, you know, body horror thing. Like, I don't know, like, what, like, Brandon Braga, like, goes on in his mind to make him think, like, oh, yeah, what if a character, like, started growing nipples in weird places? Where that's dumb. Like, human men already have nipples. Like, we don't need to grow any in addition.
I guess they didn't want to evoke the image of Trip breastfeeding a child.
But that would have been more interesting, like, make him, like, grow boobs. I mean, like, the lizard lady had boobs, so, you know, clearly, like, you know, one of
the 90s were not ready for that, Father.
But it's kind of a messed up thing, though, like, to say, like, he's, like, the first, like, pregnant man. Like, to today's world, it's like, oh, no, like,
sure.
there's men with uteruses that carry pregnancies.
They weren't there yet in the 90s thinking. Trek is always somewhat limited by us, by who we the people are at the time.
Or 2001, so not the 90s, but that's, in a lot of ways, Enterprise regresses back from, you know, where DS9 and Voyager had kind of pushed things, because we're kind of similar to now. There's so many parallels to 2001 to 2024 I keep seeing, but one of them is, you know, like, now it's like, oh, go woke or go broke, you know, like that type of that type of mentality, which, you know, has an influence on Star Trek. You know, we kind of see Star Trek's kind of gotten, like, a little less queer and a little more white, I think, the last year or so than, you know, before that, with, you know, with Picard season 3 and Strange New Worlds kind of being, like, the more the focal points of the franchise.
Father, I want to quick throw out, well, if you're finished with your thought, I have a few good things I want to say about the episode.
Yeah, go for it.
Although I think I want to mention one bad thing real quick. I think the cold opens are kind of weak on Enterprise sometimes.
You didn't like Archer in the zero-G shower?
I mean, it gives them their sexy scene for the episode, their quota to hit. And actually, I mean, it looked good and all that stuff, but it's just having him just be kind of like, oh, my shower was ruined. It's just not a cool and gripping cold open.
But it's like their ship is like, so, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but just, it was one of the things I was saying about, like, it makes them seem kind of lame and pathetic. It's like, man, you can't even make out, like, your showers work. And it's not their fault in this episode. You know, it's the fault of these hitchhikers, you know, these stowaways, you know, kind of like hiding behind their ship in their plasma exhaust. But at least, like, okay, let me see the NX-01 Enterprise be, like, a good functional ship that can, like, do its job well before you show, like, some assholes come along and break it down. And it was, I think, a big part of it was Rick Berman and Brandon Braga. They had a franchise fatigue. They were burnt out. They'd been working on the show, on this franchise, since TNG. They wanted to take a year off between Voyager and Enterprise, and UPN was like, no, you cancel Enterprise or you cancel Voyager in May, and then you get us Enterprise on the air in September, and you keep it rolling. So I feel like if they had, like, a year off, they would have been able to, you know, the only thing they didn't, like, pull together, I think, well, was the writing. But the production value was there. I think the cast is there. You know, John Billingsley is great. You know, Scott Bakula can obviously carry a show. You know, everyone loves Connor Trinneer. Like, they had all their ducks in a row except for the writing. If they had time to, like, build that writer's room. Brandon has talked about this, how he wanted to, like, develop the Bible a bit more, you know, kind of establish the world a bit more and come up with, like, some, you know, ideas for this 22nd century and not have to rely on, let's just get, like, a typical Star Trek idea. Oh, like, these aliens are, like, they have advanced technology, but their ship is broke, but so they're kind of more advanced, kind of less advanced, but because we have to help them, and there's, you know, latched onto our ship. And you could have done this on Voyager, TNG, like any other Star Trek show. It didn't really fit their new concept, their new premise they were going for. But that's about, go ahead and finish your thoughts.
Well, you know, a little like Voyager, you know, sometimes if I focus on Voyager on what it could have been, you know, more Battlestar Galactica, essentially, then, you know, I'm like, it's all disappointing in some ways. But if I take the show on its own merits, I have a lot more fun with it, and I find it's got merits that, you know, I wasn't kind of letting show through. Enterprise is a little like that, and so, yes, this is a story that could have been told in those other shows, but I actually did, I like how they figured out that the aliens were leeching power off of them. I thought that's actually kind of a neat idea, the way it was revealed. I like Trip going over, and I like the bit of realism about, like, kind of, that shows that they're a little bit more of a frontier era, where Trip's got to do the long decompression and adjust to their atmosphere time. He's got to sit there for 3 hours, And he actually has, like, an anxiety attack when he's, like, not breathing well. And they show it well because they do visual distortion and audio distortion to show you how it feels for him. And I was like, man, I was almost feeling a little anxiety myself because it felt like, yeah, like, you know, you're about to faint or something like that. So I thought that was a really cool portrayal of that. And I like his interactions with the lady. Is she just an engineer? Is she?
Yeah, I think she was their engineer. That would make sense.
And so, you know, he gets his first glimpse of a holodeck and, you know, or holodeck like technology. I found that they had pretty good chemistry. You know, is it the direction I would have chosen for the show? You know, that you kind of have the almost TOS style spacesuit, you know, woman with a tight silver jumpsuit. Probably not what I would have chosen, but execution wise, I kind of liked it. And when the Klingons show up, just like I was saying before, D7, come on, that makes me something
okay.
Interested.
So that ship we gotta talk about because that is like one of my
is this
least
some continuity thing.
This is one of the biggest fuck ups in all of Star Trek continuity. And it has been driving a lot of people crazy for a long time. But John Eaves, the wonderful ship designer, John Eaves, designed a 22nd century Klingon ship.
And instead they went with the icon?
It didn't get approved. For whatever reason, they're like, oh, no, we can't use that. So let's just like copy-paste like the CGI model we already have for a Klingon ship and use this Katinga model. It's actually like the Katinga motion picture era.
It looks more D7-ish to me, but... I trust you.
It's the CGI model that they were using on DS9 and Voyager, but like Voyager called it a D7 when it showed up there. But it's really I don't know. It's just like how do we explain this? Especially like when Discovery makes like a big deal of like the D7's introduction in season 2 of Discovery. The only thing that I think can make sense because Star Trek is so weird, it's possible to make sense of anything. But I think like these Klingons, either they have a ship from the future that came back in time, or why that happens all the time. People time travel all the time. It's either it's either that or he just had like the best ship design ever, and then with like they went to make like the D7, they're like, oh, we're just gonna copy this ship that's over 100 years old because apparently it's actually like the best ship ever. But
it's funny because, you know, I'm not really even necessarily criticizing you for this, but like I come from such a different place mentally, you know, this that.
Yeah, if you're not
a
ship person, it won't matter. But like
if you know twice about it.
Yeah, if you know ships, this looks like Abraham Lincoln, like showing up at the Ford Theater in a Tesla. Like it's that jarring to look at.
But also I'm very forgiving on it in the sense that I'm like, well, for whatever reason, they went with this one. They probably just wanted the icon.
They didn't want the icon. They it was like a last minute, like okay, well, just use the thing that we have.
The reasoning is almost irrelevant to what I'm about to say though, which is just that I could just say mentally go, yeah, that should have been a different one, but it doesn't matter to how the Klingons behave and what they do, and you know it doesn't impact the actual drama of the sequence. Like whether if the Klingons showed up in a different looking ship, the scene would have still played out the same. And so I'm just like, oh, I would just mentally say, oh, I'll pretend it was a different ship in my head, and just say that they kind of goofed. But that's the perspective that I come from. But I did like the Klingons, nevertheless. You know, like for me, I'm always excited to see those ships. I like T'Pol coming through in a clutch.
Dave, you remember, like, you got all pissy when they called them Katingas on Strange New Worlds, and you're like, why are they calling them Katingas? I think they're called D7s. It's like, this is much more egregious than that, so that's...
I would like to go and see how pissy I was, or whether it was slightly larger-than-life expression of, like, come on, guys. But, yes, anyway, it's... Father, did you like anything about the Klingons' appearance, or did that spoil it all for you?
I kind of thought it's funny when he's like, oh, I can see my house from here, when they do, like, the little holodeck thing. And that is what, like, they wanted. They just wanted, like, the holodeck thing they just want, like, that technology, and they're like, oh, this is, like, pretty cool, we'll leave you alone. But overall, one of the exciting things going into Enterprise about it being a prequel is one of the things they promised us was, like, okay, we get it, we heard y'all bitch about Fairhaven, no more holodeck episodes, you won't see any holodecks in Enterprise, we wrote way too many holodeck stories, and we're not going to fall back on that trope anymore. And so here we go, and I get to, you know, like, episode 5, and we're on a holodeck, but that's okay, it's like, it wasn't, like, part of the story or whatever, but it just kind of shows, like, man, like, they really could have, I feel so sorry for them not having, like, that year to try to flesh out the world a little bit better, because it seems very inconsistent when they're like, oh, these aliens have holodecks and all this technology, but, like, oh, these other people are, like, even more primitive than Earth. They talk about, you know, like, oh, it looks like, you know, Enterprise has, like, a bunch of weapons and stuff on it, looks like really advanced, and there's a lot of, like, you know, just inconsistencies back and forth. You know, sometimes, like, they make first contact, and it's like, this is such a big deal for humans to meet, like, a new alien race, and then sometimes they make first contact with someone that's just like, oh, look, an alien over here, you know, cool, who cares? So there's just a lot of, like, inconsistencies in here, but there's something that I will compliment this episode on, is that, like, I do chuckle at a bit of the humor when, I think it's just more Scott Bakula's performance than anything, but there's a lot when they're talking about, you know, this crazy, ridiculous sounding stuff of Tripp's pregnancy, of Scott Bakula, you know, wanting to be, like, a supportive friend and be, like, the professional captain, but he wants to laugh at some of it, and he's, like, holding it back. And it's, if you think about it, like, it's kind of messed up to be laughing at your friend going through this, but just Scott Bakula's delivery of, or performance of it, it just comes off as, like, so real and genuine and really sells it to
me. He has a sort of wry grin, like, that's kind of says, like, I'm trying, man, but it's kind of funny. yeah. Father, did you catch what I was saying about, I thought T'Pol came through with a cool kind of Kirk move, where she essentially bluffs, lies, exaggerates to the Klingons that, Archer got, high marks from the Chancellor. And, you know, is that the guy you want to blow up? And I was like, yeah, good job.
Love that addition to the franchise. Yeah, the Klingons don't lie, but they exaggerate. I'm a hyperbolic person. I exaggerate. I get, like, that Klingon, or I guess, like, the Vulcans don't lie, but they exaggerate.
You mean Vulcans?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But because Klingons exaggerate, so.
For sure. But, you know, T'Pol, because she has to bear a lot of kind of, she gets a lot of shit from these guys. They're always like, hey, you should be more like us. And so I like that the show also makes, it seems like they've given her a fair number of moments, even this early on, to make sure, you know, oh, she's also effective. But this, broadly speaking, it's kind of still a little bit rough going for me early on, because none of these episodes, like, hit as much as I wanted them to. I can find moments in all of them, but I was struggling a bit. The next episode, weirdly, I think when I was looking it up, it got some particularly low marks, but for reasons that we'll talk about more in a minute, I think I liked it more than most people did, probably. Terra Nova.
Let's move on to Terra Nova. Teleplay by Antoinette Stella. Story by Rick Berman and Brannon Braga. Directed by LeVar Burton. So this is LeVar Burton's first Enterprise episode. He'll direct several here, just coming off directing some DS9 and Voyager episodes. The synopsis here, Enterprise investigates the mystery of a lost Earth colony whose inhabitants disappeared decades before, but that doesn't mean they left. Very ominous. But yeah, this
it's
is
all
a...
shale, Father. It's all shale. I'm gonna start saying that instead of bullshit.
I like this one. I say I like it. I don't love it, but it's fun. I guess it does kind of feel like a little like of that Trek derivativeness to it, but they put an interesting enough spin on it, and it felt, you know, very prequel appropriate. I was like, oh yeah, this is something you would do on your first Warp 5 ship. You know, check in on this. You know, the colony that stopped reporting in. You know, that's a neat idea for a story. I liked the guest star. I can't remember the actor's name.
He's been in some other Trek stuff.
Eric Avary. He played a Vedic on DS9. He was a Klingon in TNG, but he's been in, like, a lot of movies and stuff. He was Elektra's dad in the Ben Affleck Daredevil movie. Yeah, but I like the language, you know, like, they're kind of they're broken English, or like their weird phrasing that they develop.
They use, like, underground metaphors, and, you know, kind of everything is, you know, or like they, you know, like, that's Digger.
Yeah, like the armadillo creatures or diggers, yeah. or he says, like, crewman, like, do you want to get your crewman back? Instead of crewman, it's like crewman.
What do they call the past? Is it not, is it just before times or the... I forget what
it was.
Is
that here or is that in the... That was here. In the Voyager episode Nemesis, where people talked weird, it was the long, long ago. But here it's the before times, I think. Or am I reversing those? But that's an example of what I was trying to be like. But, you know, it does have some of, like, Trek derivative nature. It's like a lot of the cool ideas in here came from so many recent episodes at the time.
Right. It is arguably could fit into many a Trek show, this scenario. So here's the big thing that I kind of liked about this one is that since I felt like there was a lot of, oh, our ship doesn't work. Oh, we got a Pyrrhic victory. We kind of pulled out of that one. I thought this one was a pretty clear-cut win, and I liked seeing that. Even though it's not explored with depth, I appreciate at least as a thematic, talking about, like, you know, T'Pol with the, again, with saying, hey, you can't go and forcibly relocate these people, even for their own good. They do have a culture, and we had, like, witnessed it in the episode. It's small, but they made a point to show that their lives were not just wretched misery in the caves, like some Morlocks from H.G. Wells. They have a culture. Singing, and there was like art on the walls and stuff
they
like that.
They have the
kind of glyphs.
The Rodent Skull musical instrument band.
Yeah, it sounds cool. I don't know what they use for that. Ocarinas, flutes, something cool. Woodwinds.
It was like skulls. It was like, or like what they actually used.
I meant the actual thing. Pan flute or something.
I think they had the musicians actually play with rodent skull instruments.
I hope so. I need that level of authenticity. You know, if you're not playing on a rodent skull, what are we even doing here?
That's how Jeff Russo does it on the Star Trek Discovery soundtrack. That's how they're doing it.
Father, I think that's all shale. you know what? I just wanted to mention something about this that this is not specific to this episode. In fact, it's just something I thought I made a note of here, but it's in almost all the episodes. Is that almost every episode shows people eating? Right? They have some kind of downtime, and you see Trip and Archer eating, or Trip, Archer, and T'Pol, or some different combination, and it kind of gives them a grounding that's different from Pike's dinners, where he's like, kind of, looks like it kind of clearly, although he might cook every night, you know, he only cooks for the crew occasionally on some notable occasion or get together. But here you're just, every night it is every day that, so they're doing this. It feels unique to the show.
Right.
Something that grounds them in a kind of old school vibe.
Because they just have a chef cooking all the food. They just have, a mess hall and like a dude, you know, it's like a school cafeteria, basically.
Father, do you know about those Korean shows where you just watch people eat?
I do not.
It's a thing. I'm probably mispronouncing it, but it's called mukbang.
Okay.
And I'm like, it's a popular genre of show. I just glimpsed a little bit of like, oh, why is it? Why would they do that? And you got to read up on it at some point. But I'm like, this is the show for fans of Korean eating shows.
But I pointed out when we were covering Discovery Season 3, you know, when they introduced the Daughterstadt class, that it was named after Doug Drexler's wife, late wife, Dorothy Daughter, who was the food handler, the person in like the prop department in charge of food on Star Trek Enterprise. That was her job.
Nice.
And, you know, and her husband Dougie designed the NX-01. So, you know, that marriage contributed a great deal to this TV show.
Very cool. I like that.
Just some things I got on this one, but I like there is like this great experiment is what they called it, like the Excelsior in Star Trek 3. I don't know, maybe that was like a derivative thing. Maybe they should have thought up something creative on their own, but just like that idea of like there being like this human movement to the stars post Zefram Cochrane. The thing started turning around on Earth pretty quick after first contact. That was only 6 years after, you know, Zefram Cochrane shaking hands with that Vulcan in Montana. It's only 6 years after that the SS Contesta left. So, the old lady, I guess, like, she would have been, like, I don't know how old she would be, like, in this episode. I think they say that she's 80 or 90 or something, or it was
something
80
like that,
years
yeah.
earlier. But,
That actress did a great job.
Yeah, so it's, like, arguably, like, if I live long enough, like, I might, like, you know, if I live to Zefram Cochrane's time, I might, like, get to, like, witness, like, her birth. I'll be, like, we'll overlap briefly. Nice. That's cool though, like to be like, yeah, someone who like appears in Star Trek, like we're getting like that close to it, you know, that, I thought like when Reed finds like that little tricycle wheel though, and it looks like kind of straight out of, Miri when Dr. McCoy finds that tricycle. That kind of, to me, it felt more like the other Star franchise. How, like, when they do references, they'll just, like, hey, let's just do, like, that exact same thing for no reason. Let's just, like, the exact same thing happen again.
But, it rhymes, Father.
It rhymes. But I like you. I loved, like, the, when they're saying, like, track from Earth on a skyship and, like, all of that type of stuff. The underside, underside, oversized, poison rain.
Classic sci-fi vibe.
And again, like, the moral of the story of, like, oh, yeah, like, remember your history. We all have, like, a lot more in common. If, you know, we look back, we, you know, we all came from the same place. And so it is, at the heart of it, it had something of substance. It is, like, the decision to leave these people, I guess that's, like, the biggest thing I'll compliment this episode on. But I guess the part of why I like it is when T'Pol says, let's just leave them here. You know, we're not going to teach them, like, go back to Earth and be, like, you know, well-behaved, civilized people that act like you. They're not hurting anything here. If we can, like, give them what they need to survive and be happy and healthy, just, like, let them eat their armadillos and play their rodent skull instruments. Like, just let them be Novans. Let them be happy Novans. That's so different from the original series. You know, Kirk would go to this side of paradise or the apple or whatever and be like, oh no, your whole civilization is terrible. You're not challenging yourself. You're not pushing yourself to better anything. Like, let's just completely just revolutionize all of this right now. You know, it's kind of like that mentality. So I do appreciate Terra Nova's. I like the a lot of this episode is a bit derivative, but like that was like that's a good contribution. The way that they handle the ending here, so it definitely deserves some acknowledgement on that front. And that was gonna be my big compliment, but I guess like my other adjacent big compliment is like when Phlox is like, oh yeah, I can like cure your mom's lung cancer like right now. Whenever people talk about, like, if you could have any Star Trek technology as, like, a real thing, what would you, I would be, whatever Phlox used to cure lung cancer, whatever you need to, like, make cancer, like, instantly curable, that's the Trek technology, like, I want the most.
Yeah, I liked, actually, this hit hard for me because that's what got my dad lung cancer. So, it's, you know, I didn't feel like it's making light of it or anything else. You know, Phlox takes it seriously. And, you know, he's, you know, you actually even see a little bit of process. He's like, well, you got to do this and take this afterwards. But yeah, you'll be fine. It's, you know, it's kind of one of the really things we watch Trek for is sometimes they, you know, unlike there's some people who are like, well, if I had it rough, I want everybody to have it rough. Trek is like, oh, wow, what a great idea to imagine people not having it rough. Obviously, there's still challenges, but it's nice to imagine a time when some of our challenges have been surmounted. Yeah. Which, by the way, is somewhat related to that. You know, I was saying I like that this is a definitive win for the Enterprise crew. I like that it's specifically their Roanoke colony. And so Travis is really excited about it. He's like, we solved it. And, they, you know, they let him make the report and all that stuff.
And this is what I was telling you the other day when I was talking about Judge Crater. But it was this episode. I was misremembering the Andorian incident. But I always forget Judge Crater as a thing until I watch Star Trek Enterprise. And they mention, like, Judge Crater, the famous judge who disappeared in the 20th century and no one talks about him anymore. But yeah, like, Google Judge Crater if you want to know more.
Yeah, when you mentioned it, Father, I was like, are you talking about Nancy Crater and stuff? I was like, I was also ignorant of real history.
anything else before we go to episode 7? I think it's going to be a big popular subject to talk about.
Yep, let's do it.
Okay, so let's move on to the Andorian incident. Finally, this is what everyone actually showed up for, right? Teleplay by Fred Decker, story by Rick Berman and Brandon Braga and Fred Decker. So glad Fred was in there because these boys were getting tired, I think. They needed some help at this point. Directed by Roxanne Dawson. So, hey, we had Geordi direct the last episode. Now we got B'Elanna. B'Elanna is on set directing. So this is her Enterprise debut.
She got one of the most notable episodes.
Yeah, so, you know, it was important to get this one right. Enterprise visits a Vulcan monastery only to find that it is in the midst of being taken over by the Andorians. So, the Andorians led by Shran, played by Jeffrey Combs. We heaped a ton of praise onto him when we were talking about DS9. But, Dave, what do you think about now that you've seen what's the word I'm trying to look for when you do like a whole lot of a thing? I don't know, like the plethora of acting from Jeffrey Combs.
Funny? Yeah, I'm much more familiar with the oeuvre that is Jeffrey Combs, but I also need to see more of this character before, like, Is he going to probably knock it out of the park? Yeah, I believe it. But he actually doesn't do that much in this episode. And so actually I'm kind of like where I was when Wei Yun first showed up early on. I was like, why do people care about Wei Yun? He's fine, but like I needed to see those episodes. I needed to see, watch him have an arc and see him, you know, in all these different stages. But you know, by the way, I will say, you know, I'm just looking at the screenshot. Those Andorians, they look so cool.
My ideal Andorian is the most recent one we got in season 2 of Strange New Worlds. They have like the cool
scar. The non-wiggles.
But I want his antennae to move. But like the rest of his head is perfect, and especially like his hair and everything. But these Andorians do look really good, and they kind of remind me of the guy we see in the Monster Maroon in Star Trek 4, who's an Andorian. They kind of have like the similar forehead, but it was a great redesign, and just like the moving antennae was such like a cool technological achievement. It was like a neat thing to see on TV. It's like, yeah, this now you're seeing like, you know, they're putting in like the effort and the polish, and a lot of Enterprise does look great. It's sad that, yeah, within like the, you know, the small window of time they had to build this show, like they were able to get like the ball rolling pretty good on like everything except for the writing, I think.
This episode for me had like a bunch of things going for it. Not just the arrival of, you know, the Andorians, but I actually liked, you know, I was interested in, I can kind of actually recall watching this in, would it have been 2001, Fathery? Is that right? Or 2002
at
this point?
Yeah, this would have aired in October of 2001, the week before the Buffy musical, because the VHS copy I taped on UPN had the little promo at the bottom of the screen when we see Shran and the Andorians on screen, and then at the bottom of the screen it says, hey, tune in to UPN next week for Buffy the musical.
So what I like is like, it starts off cool. I'm like, oh, interesting Vulcan monastery. That's interesting. Find out more about the Kolinar and stuff like that.
Rick Berman and Brandon Braga watched the motion picture, because they didn't know original series stuff before doing Enterprise.
Right. And I think it looks good too. The monastery looks neat. Pretty solid costuming inside, a decent sense of space and interiors on it. And then, yeah, you have this intrigue, a hostage situation, introduction of Andorians. I definitely wanted to see some old school TOS guys when I was first watching this, and always now too. So that was great. But the big thing that actually shocked me, even though it's like, it's the obvious outcome, is that yes, they actually are hiding a transmit, you know, a relay station or whatever there the Vulcans are.
The surveillance technology.
I think what I thought was going to happen was like, oh, one of them is a spy or something like that. I didn't know it was going to be this kind of systemic, big scale espionage, you know, Vulcan kind of military guile was going on. And I was like, I was kind of shocked when I saw it.
The twist that, I thought the Vulcans were the good guys and the Andorians are the bad guys, but the other way around, everything the Andorians were, well, I don't know about everything that was true. But their whole claim of like, no, like these Vulcans are spying on us from this monastery was 100% true. And the Vulcans were 100% lying when they were like, no, we're just a monastery.
The last thing I would have expected was that Archer tells T'Pol, give them all the information you just got. Like, that was pretty wild. And because, you know, they had made the Andorians very intimidating, big old pieces of shit in how they did it. So you're like, no way these guys are in the right, or at least somewhat in the right, largely in the right. Since, I guess, the premiere, this was the first one to really feel like a really great episode to me.
Yeah, and I think they were trying to make a TOS feeling episode. Like, Rick Berman and Brian Braga as guys who like did not watch that show, were not fans of that show, and didn't really, I guess, understand the appeal of it, but they were trying to tap into that for Enterprise. And I think here it shows them like, oh yeah, they got a handle on it here. You know, just the way that Trip and Archer, when they team up, there's a weird guy around the corner, like, oh, hey, Trip, you know, you might want to come look at this over here. And they kind of, you know, they coordinate, they work together to just tackle a guy. And that's so Nimoy and Shatner doing that in the original series. It's just like, I can picture it.
It was nicely done with kind of all visual cues. I mean, I know he speaks as a kind of, hey, but he's giving him these looks like, there's a dude over here. so yeah, very, very cool scene.
A couple of Enterprise tropes, but we get more of Hawkish Reed. You know, he's acting captain, so you kind of kind of have that. You kind of have like a bit of tension, like, oh, our guy is in charge up on the ship, and he's a bit of a hothead, so that might actually that might actually make things worse. I think that's fun. And also, Scott Bakula was insistent that when Archer gets beat up, he really gets beat up. And when he gets punched, he looks like a guy who got punched. So the Andorians whip the shit out of him. Like,
it looked painful to me.
Yeah, they rough him up.
Yeah, it looked like the kind of thing where you don't just get up a few seconds later and you're fighting and you're fine. you know, I was like, okay, all right, you got to give some as good as you get, which is why in an episode or two after this, when he does, you know, get some good licks on somebody, I was like, okay, good. I need Archer to occasionally punch somebody back, too.
I do get frustrated with Berman-era Trek frequently forgetting that Vulcans are supposed to be, like, really strong. Like, that, they hammered that into our heads in the original series, how strong punch Spock was. But I kind of wish that, like, they would have shown some Vulcan strength somewhere in here.
Yeah, like, if he punched the dude he thought was kind of, like, a foppish, you know, just like espionage guy impersonating a priest, and then that guy just like laughs off his punch and pitches him into the wall.
I mean, I'm kind of okay with like Archer punching the guy, but I just wanted to just at some point just show that like these monks aren't like a bunch of pussies, you know, like they could actually like rough some dudes up if they wanted, you know, they're just using like Vulcan restraint, but they're actually like, they're not like helpless, like Vulcans are strong.
Right.
I almost feel like that could have been part of like the power struggle to be like the Andorians. Like they have to like run in like guns blazing because like, you know, the Vulcans are so much stronger. Just like the way that like their nation state seems to be, you know, they have the advantage in this conflict.
But thematically they wanted to show the Vulcan like intelligence, the guile there. And so I can kind of understand them wanting to sort of downplay their physicality. For this episode, they wanted to show, like, oh, these guys who we usually put on such a pedestal for their math and science and skills, they can just as easily apply that towards militarism, towards espionage, and that's the scary thing that makes them unnerving.
The Indiana Jones Legends of the Hidden Temple types, you know, going through the catacombs. I liked that. That was all fun. That was neat. That was a fun thing to do with Vulcans. We hadn't really, you know, seen much before. And I think it had like a bit of influence. We've seen a lot of that stuff after. So I appreciate that. They still have to do like a little bit of sexual tension. You know, they have to like remind everyone how hot T'Pol is when Archer's like, here, come crawl under this blanket with me. But it's funny, like the nasal numbing agent had worn off and she really didn't want to. Like that is funny.
It's such a fanfic type scene. It's the trope in fanfic of like the hurt comfort thing. But it's funny because like, you know, we will shortly start to see them putting a little bit more effort into connecting her to Trip. But yeah. Yes, in this one briefly with Archer.
So I'm not like a huge like shipper in the Star Trek. I don't go all in on like the big ships, but like I do have like my favorite pairings that I mention when we're talking about Star Trek. And I love that the fandom appeals to so many people on so many different levels. Some people like get really into it, perhaps on an unhealthy level, but I don't want to judge. I guess that was very judgmental, but I'm a fan of the Trip and T'Pol stuff. I do like when they're flirty. I like their chemistry. So I get the shipping crowd when like they don't like who characters are being paired off with on screen. It bothers them. Because it does kind of bother me when they have like T'Pol and Archer stuff together. It's like, no, you're supposed to be with Trip. And I'd be fine with like T'Pol being like, you know, polyamorous and having like multiple partners. But I just don't really buy it. Like the Archer one doesn't seem I don't know. That one seems forced, and I don't know.
It's more like an old X-Men comics, like that one panel where Xavier is like, I cannot help but be attracted to Jean. And I'm like, oh, whoa.
T'Pol's got a few years on Archer, so I don't...
Yeah, well...
They will reveal her age in the show, but I don't know. I won't say here if anyone who...
A gentleman does not say a Vulcan's age. By the way, Father, you were talking about the Indiana Jones stuff. Yeah. There's a bit Archer said that I felt like this was a cool line when... That one monk is like, you know, you can't see the sacred relics, but he's like, the Andorians have already seen it. He's like, a couple more humans won't make a difference.
Yeah, and then it's also foreshadowing, like, oh, they actually had stuff down there they really didn't want the humans to see, so.
Oh, yeah, speaking of foreshadowing, there's a kind of a neat bit, you know, once you've seen the episode, of course, early on where they realize that one of the Vulcan star charts is screwed up.
I love that. That was such a good thing. That's an important thing to put in there. It's like, yeah, how the hell are they explorers if in the first episode they're like, oh, the Vulcans gave us these star charts that tell us how to...
Right.
But you need that, because, like, okay, sometimes they're going to be like, hey, go to the Klingon homeworld. Okay, they're going to have to know where that is. But then other times they're going to be like, hey, we just found this comet out here. Look, it's Archer's comet. So by saying, like, oh, they have star charts, but there's some blanks in them. And it's like, oh, look, the Vulcans are so cocky, but maybe they're not as great as they are. That was a great decision. Whoever came up with that, bravo. The show needed that extra year so that Brandon Braga and Rick Berman could have thought of more, like, good world building things like that.
Yeah. And then also, there may be, you know, now that we know that they have this duplicity to them at times, that there can be things deliberately omitted too. You know, they're like, oh, we don't want you messing around in those affairs. We don't want you poking around there. So we're not even going to put it on the star charts that we show you. So yeah, it's a neat bit of foreshadowing that at the time I just thought it was like, oh yeah, it's just so that we don't think that the crew is, you know, like only following the dots that the Vulcans already made. But in fact, yes, it is the thematic for the whole episode.
Final thing on this one, then I'll shut up because we got two more eps to talk about. But I just think it's interesting now, looking at this, that I remember Rick Berman and Brandon Braga talking about how they wanted to do this as the Gorn incident instead of the Andorian incident and bring the Gorn into a recurring threat in the Star Trek Enterprise. And they didn't do that because they said when they sat down and started watching the original series for the first time in their lives and they watched Arena and they're like, man, that show makes it like really clear that that's the first time they met the Gorn. And I guess like no prequels should be doing things with the Gorn. And that was their conclusion in 2001.
But if they had done it with the Gorn, we might have gotten something closer to the original series Gorn and prevented Strange New Worlds its one notable misstep. Damn it. Damn it, Enterprise.
I mean, I think I'm glad they didn't do anything with... I actually think they would have done worse stuff with the Gorn.
No. But... The one time they used a Gorn was cool in the Mirror Universe episode. Mirror Darkly or whatever.
I guess I love the use of it. I don't like how it looks, but I don't want to talk about that. But I just want to point that out, that like I agree with their decision not to have used the Gorn, and I think Strange New Worlds maybe should have also made that choice.
But the Andorian stuff clearly does work, so.
But episode 8, Breaking the Ice, written by Maria. I hate the French names. I shouldn't say hate, but I always struggle with them. Yakometen and Andre Yakometen, but directed by Terry Wendell.
Okay.
With a Vulcan ship on their tail, Enterprise decides to investigate a comet. So, that makes it sound like not a ton happens. I guess, like, not a ton happens, but I kind of have a little bit of fun with this one. It does have, like, some of that frustration of, like, man, they can't even, like, land their shuttle on a comet and, like, you know, build a snowman and play around on the snow and then, like, get in the shuttle and, like, come back to the ship. It's like, even that was too much for them to do. But that is kind of the point of the episode, is, like, we got to be okay, like, asking for help, you know? Like, you gotta be strong enough to show your vulnerability type of thing. So I do like that message, but I don't know. What do you think of Breaking the Ice?
I like that they pretty constantly, as a thematic, remind you that they are outstripped technologically by most anybody they might face. And so they got to be kind of smart about how they deal with stuff. I don't think the show is always... Sometimes they still want him to be Kirk, and they kind of forget about it a little bit, but I like that. I like that they kind of have to struggle to do things that we take for granted on Star Trek. I like them having to have a little bit of trouble mining on the thing. Although the only thing I didn't like about that was that Archer dresses him down for making a snowman because the Vulcans are watching.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? I even if they were trying to follow protocol at that point, I feel like that's kind of, you know, it feels like he's backing the Vulcans over his own crew. I'm glad, and I almost wish they had made more of a point of it, that they made some FU Vulcan ears for the snowman.
I was okay with Archer, you know, getting on their asses. I thought that was kind of funny. But because Reed is like, you know, Reed is always like the by-the-book soldier type. And so he'd be like, that was so embarrassing for him to be the one caught doing that.
It's
like one of the few times in his career he probably like allowed himself to be silly.
It's true. And I think, you know, the actor can pull it off a little bit of lightness. So it's too bad that they don't give him more of that.
Yeah, maybe if they had a year to flesh out these characters, but they're like, oh no, like we got to, okay, Malcolm Reed, he's British, so he's like super proper, and like he likes everything to be like you know, like fancy and by the book and like, you know, on time and correct, and that's as deep as we're going to get with him. You know, he's very British and stuffy and British.
Right. He's kind of, he's master and commandery. We'll get to, what's the name of the Vulcan in this? Vanek? Is that it?
Yeah.
We'll get to him in just a second.
And that pissed me off so much in 2001. I remember, like, wanting to rip my hair out. Because
was it Sanic?
The Vulcan ranks make no sense. Because T'Pol's a sub-commander, but they say that her rank as a sub-commander is greater than Tripp's rank as a full commander. So, okay, does that mean, like, Vulcans don't have captains? Like, their captains are called commanders? Which, that would make sense. That's, like, Romulan style. So that'd be cool if, like, Romulans and Vulcans have, like, the same command structure. Oh, what a neat idea. That's a really cool idea. And then we get Captain Vanek. I'm like, oh, why isn't he Commander Vanek? This whole, like, cool idea doesn't make any sense. Now, like, is there Captain Commander and Sub-Commander? So how is T'Pol's rank as a Sub-Commander greater than Tripp's Starfleet rank as a Commander? It's like, it doesn't make sense. It's just, like, it's things, like, if you could actually have writers sit down and make, like, a show Bible and be like, here is how Vulcan rank structure works, you avoid stuff like that.
Well, so I'm going to hold off on what I was going to say earlier. We'll get to it in a minute. It was kind of a bigger overview, but let's stick with Vanek for a second. I thought he was a little cartoonishly aloof and jerky, kind of in that same way I felt about... who's the dipshit from Chicago?
Captain Shaw.
where I was like, okay, this is a little one-note. And he was just like, man, he just shoots down everything.
Yeah.
And yet, I kind of liked the unique problem he presented, which is that Archer, you know, this is something I don't think we've ever seen in any other Trek, a person who is your kind of cultural superior technologically, and you're also kind of indebted to, so you don't want to be confrontational with them, but they're like hand-holding you and watching you. That's a unique situation. He's got to, like, kind of walk this line. He's like, oh, it's funny. These Vulcans showed up right as we're about to do something. Oh, they showed up again. But I thought that in execution, this guy was just a little much. What did you think?
I think he embodies the 22nd century Vulcan. So I just kind of think of him as, like, he's like proxy Saval. You know, like, Saval couldn't be there. So they gave, like, a Saval-like dude. But he very much, he, like, represents, like, these are the Vulcans of Enterprise. So this is how most Vulcans are going to behave until season four when big things happen on Vulcan. But, I'm going to keep saying, like, just wait till season four. I'm really looking forward to getting into that stuff.
That's right. I will not take it so literally as to think, like, that everything prior to it is a waste of time. I know that is not your intent. But that is, like, the best of the best.
I have some other thoughts, though. The Vulcan ship, I love the warp ring around it and how it looks like that weird Enterprise representation we saw hanging in the rec room in the motion picture that was never really explained other than...
Is that the first time we see this ship?
Yes. So, this is the first time, like, they established, like, in lore that, like, Vulcans had, like, the warp rings. Like, that is their thing. There's a little connection to that in season two that I'll bring up when we get to that. I like the show ending on the pecan pie. I like the pecan pie. The Tripp and T'Pol stuff. I kind of like that, like, that he was the one who saw her letter about her arranged marriage. And I was like, oh, look, Rick and Brandon, y'all did it. Y'all watched the original series. You know, a mock time. You know how, like Vulcan arranged marriages work. That's cool. Like, I didn't know y'all had it in you. So that's cool. I like that. I like seeing my original series represented in Berman era Star Trek. And, just kind of like, I don't know, like the tension between the two of them. I like it more now than I did in 2001 because I'm a fan of how that relationship develops. So it's fun to revisit it and see it now in kind of those early fledgling states when they were figuring it out. Phlox talking to the children, how when they do like the little message for, I love that it was County Kerry, Ireland. It's like, oh, this very like real place. And when they're doing like their whole, you know, we're going to make like this little, I don't know, letter or video or what. I guess like they were doing like a cameo. It was like cameo for the school children. But Phlox is really cool. And he's like talking about like explaining like germ theory to school children. And I think it's the first time the word poop is ever said in Star Trek when they're discussing the. But
finally.
It justifies Discovery's use of so much with like synthesizers, which seemed very similar to replicators, but it's like they had some synthesization technology as early as Enterprise, so
yep.
We should allow it in Discovery.
Just a less, you know, broad, like it wasn't quite does anything kind of thing.
And Archer's Comet is kind of neat. I like Archer. Let's mention Archer's Comet. Just be like, I don't know, like we flew past Archer's Comet or something.
Yeah.
I assume it's still out there. Joel pointed out in our live audience that there's multiple episodes here where a shuttle falls into a hole and has to be lifted up. So just, it does kind of make them seem like, oh yeah, they're kind of dumb and pathetic. But I mean, that would be like the first starship should have part of that. So,
yeah, I mean, to me, I don't think dumb and pathetic when I see that. I think this is the, you know, that is the baseline. Like, it's a buy-in to the show, is that the technology has not been tested in anything remotely like the distances they're going. And so, yeah, that's like, that's normal. It's like a ship, you know, springing a leak. It's going to happen.
And I think I struggle with a bit of the inconsistency with it, where it's like, sometimes they seem like, you know, like they're really on top of their shit, and sometimes they don't. And I feel like it's just the writers, they would, you know, be stuck. They're like, man, we gotta have 26 episodes. We gotta push something out. And they would be like, okay, let's just, you know, go back on like the familiar type stuff we're used to writing. And they'd kind of like lose their handle on this new premise they had. And so it kind of weaves in and out. Like, we're like the young fledgling amateurs. They're like, no, this is like a typical Star Trek show.
Right. I agree with you on that. I can sort of put that to the side, or that's what, you know, my I'm sort of trying to do, because I'm like, I think I'll enjoy the show more if I can, except that there is that's just kind of baked into it as an uneasy balance between those two. But they definitely, there's a sometimes uneasy balance.
Yeah, I don't have anything else. I will say, like, for 23 years, I always thought when Reed is saying, like, we'll have to do something special to celebrate, I thought he was talking about, like, the explosion when, like, they blow up the mines or whatever. And he's like, I was hoping for a bit more symmetry. It's like, oh, he likes to, like, blow stuff up. But, like, oh no, he's talking about, like, the snowman, I guess. I had never, like, figured that out until now.
Wait, what was the something special he wanted to do?
Build the snowman, right?
Oh, right. Yes,
the snow Vulcan, I should say.
Right. For him, a rare case of kind of a little childlike quality. You know, what I wanted to mention is, I feel like there's a bit of a plot-wise, a slight dead zone when they get to the extended thing with the kids, you know? But I also like that as a bit of realism, because they, like, really show, like, the whole, like, five-minute video that they make, and I think everybody does a good job in it. I actually wasn't sure, you know, when Archer, after it wraps, and he's like, you know, what did you think? And, like, to Paul, or no, Hoshi and Trip kind of sigh, like, oh, What a mess. And I was like, no, you all did pretty good. Even the stumbling, I think the kids probably were pretty happy with it. But it did that, and the fact that it's a low stakes episode, it's just kind of some mining and, you know, some awkwardness with the Vulcans. It occurs to me that this is kind of a one of those cozy episodes in a way. Not quite holodeck cozy, but there's no big stakes. So, like, I feel like if I watch an episode of Discovery that's, you know, one of those universe-ending episodes, this would be a good episode to go and watch afterwards to kind of come down a little bit and relax. And I actually, I did like seeing the T'Pol-Trip connection. That was one of the big things for me, was seeing that start to form. Trip giving a little bit and being on the side where he's not being antagonistic towards her and he's got to apologize. But also just being a bit of a, you know, that kind of straightforward country boy, ideal earther or American, where he's like, well, what do you want to do to Paul, who is, he's correct. She is entrenched enough in some weird traditions that it's, she can't see out of it. And so I actually really liked that stuff. It's a lightweight episode, but I kind of was enjoying it the whole time. So a solid one for me.
Then the last one we got, Civilization, written by Phyllis Strong and Mike Sussman. So I guess it took 8 and 9. These are the only two episodes we're talking about that did not have Rick Berman or Brandon Braga involved in the writing, at least in the credits. But I suspect they were probably still, you know, heavily involved. But, or I should point out, this is directed by Mike Vahar. The synopsis reads, Enterprise finds a fully inhabited Earth-like planet where some of the inhabitants are suffering from a mysterious disease. This episode, you know, I kind of have, like, a good time with, you know, the Andorian incident, Terra Nova, the Andorian incident breaking the ice. So it's kind of like a good, you know, I like the pilot and then, or the premiere, I should say. And then I kind of struggle with, like, the next two. And then I get three that I like a bit more. And then this one, it's like, I don't know. This one is a bit of a mixed bag. There's things I like, things I dislike. But
I agree with that.
It's a bit like, I get a lot of like the inconsistency here, because it's kind of like, oh, look, it's like the first time we're going to do like the Star Trek thing where you disguise yourself and, you know, infiltrate a civilization, the name of the episode, a very like Rick Berman style, just name the episode, you know, one word. But
they should have called it Disguise.
I don't know, maybe we could look at this like, oh, this is like Enterprise, like getting good at what they do. And like, because they stand up to these guys, they have a bit of like a sophisticated operation, these alien antagonists that we encounter. But like they bring them down, like, I don't want to say easily, but I don't know, pretty quick. It's like they're only here for a day or two. And it's traditional, you know, episodic television Star Trek, where it's like you show up on a planet, there's a problem, you solve it and leave.
You know, these guys had a huge operation below ground, but it does seem like above ground, I can almost buy this, they weren't too worried about, their security protocols above ground were kind of crap, and that's probably because these guys were sort of pre-industrial civilization. They're like, what are they going to do? And, but you know, they ended up finding some other guys just like themselves who were, you know, wearing disguises.
That is a hell of a coincidence, huh? Like you,
I mean, they went to the one city on the, or maybe there's, these guys are actually all over the world.
But they do, you know, eventually like detect the antimatter reactor and, you know, that, go and investigate it. But like, that's not why they came to this planet. So.
Right. Oh, you know what? As I'm looking at this still, I'm reminded, I don't know why, but I thought this one was like, both that the costuming was some of the better that I've seen, and then I also thought that the lighting was kind of nice. It had that Renaissance Italy kind of rich, warm ambers glow to it, and the sun and stuff on all the apothecary shops. Like, I don't know, maybe it just felt that, you know, like the set designers were kind of having fun, and then whoever lit it was doing a really good job, I thought.
Well, Enterprise, like, they did really try to make, like, Enterprise, like, look good, and it, like, you know, you compare, like, Enterprise to Voyager and Deep Space Nine, and it's like, especially, like, Deep Space Nine didn't have, like, the big network money from UPN that Voyager had. But, like, there is, like, a big step up in, you know, quality. It's the first time Star Trek went to, like, a 16:9 format, like, shot, like, in HD. Like, I still had a standard definition TV. I had, like, the black bars on, like, the top and bottom when I was watching it. But yeah, because I was watching it on a rectangle TV before they turned to, or on a square TV before they turned to rectangles. But the lady that they introduce, Rianne, they give Archer a little love interest. So they kind of get in like that Kirk thing of like, oh, he's going to like, you know, he's going to meet like a cute chick on every planet that he's going to get to kiss and then bounce off to the next planet. But I liked her. She was fun. I liked that was cool that like, oh, in like this, you know, old world, she's this pharmacist. But, you know, like she would have been like a good scientist in our society, if she'd been born on Denobula or Earth or Vulcan. I liked when Phlox pointed that out.
Yeah, same here.
The fake face, when they pull off like the rubber face and it looks like lizard skin underneath, like V.
Yeah.
I've been watching some of these episodes in our Discord. If anyone wants to, you know, watch Star Trek Enterprise with me, if you're up late, and Joel, regular in the live audience, was watching this one with me, pointed out like, oh, it's like V, the miniseries.
Yeah, V is like every kid who watched that when I was a kid freaked their shit the first time that one of those human faces got peeled off and there was a lizard man beneath it. That's probably why there's so many weird conspiracies about lizard men people, because of all the kids who grew up in the 80s and were scarred by V.
I liked the use of the transporter at the end when they beam the reactor to space and then hit it with a torpedo next to the enemy ship. I thought that was a cool way of showing, like, the Enterprise is Earth's first starship. It's not going to be the biggest, baddest ship out there, but our characters are so smart and clever and creative, they're going to come up with this inventive way to win the day. And I thought that was neat.
You know, you mentioned this feeling like Archer feeling Kirk-like, and I definitely got some TOS vibes off of this episode.
This is very TOS-ish.
Fisticuffs, phaser battles, kisses a beautiful woman. And they do a kind of neat, it's not like a big gambit, it's not like, you know, like the extended battle in Balance of Terror, but they pull off a neat gambit to beat a technologically superior foe, and, you know, it's all very cool, you know, that is some fun TOS stuff. I don't know that it's, like, great, but
the kissy scene.
It was fun.
The kissy scene when the translator breaks.
Yes.
I like that because it was so different from, like, typically you do that when it's like, oh, here comes a guard, let me kiss you, so that, you know, they don't suspect anything. I like that, like, it wasn't that they did something different with it, where, like, the communicator fritzed out and Archer panicked and then just started, like, making out with her and kind of confused, like, what's her reception going to be? And then, like, he pauses and she's just saying gibberish and alien language, and then he just starts kissing her again to go back to fiddling with the communicator. And yeah, it's just fun to watch because then the audience is like, oh, I want to know, like, what was her reaction to the kiss? What was she trying to say? You know, like, get the communicator fixed, Archer. You know, we want to know what's going on. So, and then the Akali, that's how you say it, I think. Akali.
That's right.
One of those was right, I'm sure. But I like that the species shows up again in Star Trek Discovery Season 4. A slight spoiler for Discovery, I guess. But, you know, that show has a lot of scenes that take place in the distant future, the 32nd century. 1,000 years after this. So you think about that, like, you know, like Star Trek Picard takes place, the final season is, I believe, 2401. You know, you go back in time like 1,000 years before that, you'd be, you know, right before the Renaissance, you know, in the 15th century. It's like, oh yeah, like 1,000 years, like in the time of Discovery, yeah, like if these people are on the same trajectory as humans, yeah, they'll be like out in space traveling around at high warp. So I like that. Cool way of using the universe.
I want to go watch that Disco episode. I might actually do that later tonight.
Yeah, it's going to be Discovery Season 4, I don't know, like episode 7, 8, okay. 6, somewhere in there, like near the middle. It's the one that it introduces Tarka.
Okay.
I think. Pretty sure. I haven't seen that stuff in a hot minute either, so I need to revisit it too.
Father, as I'm looking at my notes, I don't have a lot to say about Rianne other than, you know, she's a pretty good, resourceful, and interesting, you know, brief love interest. I thought she visually reminded me a little of Terry Hatcher. And the other thing I wanted to mention about Garrosh was that nothing super notable, but when he does his full heel turn, I think he's a pretty good villain. He really seems like he kind of is like, don't you dare.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's like, don't you dare mess with me. He's like, you're nothing.
He plays a baddie in Voyager. He's in episode 1.
He's
good
at it.
Voyager, Season 4, Episode 25.
Oh, you know what I wanted to mention? This is something in this episode, but also in some of the others, too, is, you know, when they show that manufacturing big bay thing under the underground, it's like, you know, it's a pretty good effect, I think. It looks spacious, and it reminded me of the big, the spy room with the array at the Vulcan Temple. And, like, I was just like, oh, just there's some casually pretty neat effects in these shows. Oh, the whole time, the Enterprise looks great. I think it's a great design, the NX-01. But yeah, I specifically want to compliment their ability to create these big open spaces with movement in there. Probably some CG, I think. You know, like when just like when birds fly by randomly. Yeah, I thought it looked cool.
Yeah, and I can't compliment the look of the show enough, you know. In 2001, it looked gorgeous. A lot of the CG shots don't hold up. It's like when they do like a whole, like, you know, when it shows like that crewman, like in Strange New World, when he's like out in like the wilderness, or like some like the Vulcan like surveillance station, when they do like the big shot of it, like some of that stuff, like it's only on screen for a few seconds. It's like, it's good that it's only on screen for a few seconds, because it doesn't hold up on modern standards. But at the time, it was like really high budget, quality, like network TV.
That's you watching it on 4K, Father. On my normal flat screen, it's I think they hold up pretty well. Like, I think, you know, the intent comes through. You know, it'd be like, you know, it's not like, I don't think like Ray Harryhausen's special effects hold up poorly just because I can tell they're stop
either.
Motion. Now Ray Harryhausen is like a gold standard, I realize, I'll push back a little bit on that one. I'm going to keep watching as we go through some more of these, but I think some of that stuff actually holds up pretty well. Like, I think they're delivering, it did what the scene called for it to do, conveyed what it wanted it to.
But that's going
to
be it for this week. But I'm really excited about like the next round of episodes, because there's a couple of like big stuff in there. We're going to be covering Fortunate Son up to Rogue Planet, so episodes 10 through 18. That'll be more to talk about, because we kind of we didn't really talk about like Broken Bow as much, so we kind of just mainly focused on 7 episodes here, so it'll be a bigger chunk next week. But there's some really great stuff in there. We get the return of Silic and the Sulabons. We get there's even more Andorian action. The Nausicaans, those dudes who stabbed Picard through the heart, they're going to show up. So
yeah, I don't like. I always kind of remember the early stuff best, and like, but we're already going to be getting into stuff that I've probably only seen once. Some of these episodes, like I've seen, like the Andorian incident, some other ones I've seen maybe 2 or 3 times in one way, shape, or form. But this next batch is going to be getting into more unknown territory for me, so or less remembered territory. So I'm looking forward to that.
And I think that if people are watching this, you know, let us know if this is your first time going through Enterprise, or how you feel about these episodes, reevaluating them now in 2024. But that'll be fun. So please come back and be part of the conversation with us, and check us out live if you can Friday at 7 p.m. Central, or listen to us later wherever you get your podcast. And until next time, as always, live long and prosper, y'all.
Listen to the Text Trek podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or at text-trek.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/text-trek, and follow Fathery on Twitter at TXTrek. Please support us by liking our videos and subscribing to our channel on YouTube. Thank you, and take care.